Hey, Random Chatter listeners, welcome back to Random Chatter Interviews. This episode is sponsored by all of our Patreon donors. To learn more about how you can contribute to the Random Chatter Network and the perks you can get for your contributions, visit patreon.com/randomchatter. In this episode, I sit down with Derek Beebe, one of the most famous, or infamous, members of our staff. Derek is the face behind our Facebook, bombed out in the past movie draft, and will somehow be feeding people on the new sci-fi pubcast. We talk about his passion for writing and his love of the Subway steak and egg. It's a hell of a ride, folks. Derek is a great personality in our Slack community, and it was a lot of fun to chat with him. Enjoy the interview. Hey, Derek, how you doing today?
I am great, Tim.
Fantastic. I appreciate you taking the time to join me on Random Chatter Interviews.
I have nothing better to do.
Been absolutely looking forward to getting you on. You are, in fact, the most often mentioned Random Chatter member. You usually get referenced in darn near every podcast out there.
I've been noticing that lately, yeah.
Quite a bit. I think we all have been noticing that. And then the funny thing is that if you haven't come up, then someone comments in the podcast, hey, no one mentioned Derek, but then, well, there it is.
Well, there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. So let's see. So Derek, just to kind of throw the lay of the land out there, folks may wonder why we so often reference you. You are a regular in our Slack channel.
Yes. One might say I'm an infestation of the Slack channel.
What one might say that. That might be a little harsh. I mean, I would kind of go like invasive species, not quite infestation.
A friendly tapeworm.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. A friendly tapeworm. Sure. Sure. We'll have to check with some biologists on that. So you are a Random Chatter staff member. You have been for a while. You run our Facebook account.
Yep.
So you are our face of Facebook, kind of incognito. Many people may not realize that it is, in fact, you that they're communicating with. You have guested on a Random Chatter movie draft.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a couple seasons ago. How did you do?
I did not do as well as I thought I would.
I remember listening to that episode. You did an insane quantity of research.
Yes, I did.
Which was interesting because you threw a lot of facts out there. You had a lot of stuff organized and you had, you know, mentioning, hey, here's cast and crew. Here's things that cast and crew had done before. Here is calendar-wise what they're up against. So you had a lot of stuff out there, which I thought was pretty helpful. I mean, probably to everyone, to give people some perspective on a lot of the different films.
Yeah, I'm hugely into movies and TVs of all sorts. So I follow this stuff closely. I log into Box Office Mojo every day and track the box office results.
Wow.
I follow it pretty closely.
Oh, that's cool. How have you done on the listener side of Movie Draft?
Have they updated it recently? The last time I looked, it wasn't updated yet.
I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, I probably didn't do well because I was completely wrong about Beauty and the Beast. I thought that was going to do maybe $100 million, and it was a $1.2 billion movie. It outgrossed The Fate of the Furious. I'm completely floored by that. I did not see that coming at all.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people were optimistic about it, but I'm not so sure that anyone thought it would be as big as it was. I actually just very recently saw it, and that was on an airplane.
Me too.
And I thought it was a really well-done movie. It was incredibly well-done.
Yeah, it was. I would probably say it was superior to the original, actually.
Yeah. I mean, obviously different, but they did, you know, CG does some absolutely incredible things that they, you know, can pull off with movies now.
I really didn't think it would do that well because Cinderella did, I believe, $500 million global. And even that, to me, was surprising. But I just assumed that Beauty and the Beast would do about the same. It would be, you know, basically match Cinderella. But to do almost three times as much money as that? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty mind-blowing, very surprising. But they pulled it together well. They had a nice cast. I mean, obviously, they followed most of the story beats and really pulled in a lot of CG to make a lot of things happening. You know, whenever you're making whenever you are humanizing inanimate objects, that's, you know, a serious stretch. And absent, you know, doing an outright animated film, I think they had all the right effects in place and they made it happen pretty well. It was very convincing.
And I thought that the additions to the story were good and you know, flowed well. It, you know, it didn't feel like a cheap add-on. Mm-hmm. It actually felt like an integral part of the story. Like in the first one, they don't explain why the kitchen staff gets cursed too, but here they kind of do. So that helps.
Yeah, exactly. And I liked at the end the reunification of the kitchen staff with their families, and I thought that was pretty good. I thought it was pretty well done. And so let's see, you are also joining, speaking of cast and crew, you are joining the cast of the upcoming sci-fi pubcast.
That's what I'm told.
You've been hired. You were hired on by Joel as a kitchen manager.
Yes.
Despite a insane lack of experience, an insane lack of caring about food hygiene.
I'm just trying to save Joel some money. I'm there to save Joel some money to make a profit. Okay, that's all.
That's fine. It just, you know, I'll make sure there's a sign posted outside the pub that says, you know, bring BYOF, bring your own food. So, but no, you have a lot of interest and a lot of knowledge in sci-fi. You do some of your own writing. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But yeah, I think you have some great depth and some great understanding. And from what I've heard of the beta episodes of the pubcast I've listened to, and one episode I did happen to drop by on, I did not eat any of your food. But we had we had some pretty fun discussions. So I think you're a nice addition to the permanent hosting of that show, and I think that's going to really help drive some great discussion.
Thank you. I do also write movie reviews on the website as well.
Oh yes, that's right. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah. So on randomchatter.com, you can go up there and check out a lot of the movie reviews that we have up there, the vast majority of which are written by Derek. Again, Derek writes quite a bit and really, really great writer.
I basically like everything. I don't really trash on movies the way a lot of people do. I try to find a reason to enjoy something rather than to find a reason to not enjoy it. I try to be positive.
When we went to Star Wars Celebration, on one of the stages, Justin Bulger appeared. It was the Toys R Us stage. Kind of a smaller stage in the middle of the vendor hall. Justin was asked a number of things in terms about, you know, what he does and what some of his interests are. And I think because it was the Toys R Us stage, some of the slant went to things like action figures and that kind of stuff in terms of the discussion. And it went to the things that he collected and all that. But one of the kind of early in the conversation, the interviewer was asking Justin about the things that he liked and didn't like about Star Wars. And Justin came back with, I think, what was a great answer in saying that he's gained a new perspective and a new appreciation for everything in Star Wars.
And now that they pay him too.
Well, yeah, that's part of it. But that he doesn't completely see things in that dichotomy of, well, I like this and I don't like that. It's more of a, I like this, but I just like that less. Because he sees, you know, he's looking at things with a bigger picture and understands that, well, hey, maybe someone doesn't like, say, Jar Jar. But you can look at Jar Jar and have an understanding, if not an appreciation, for where Jar Jar falls in the storyline and what he does for the story. You know, you may not necessarily agree with all the antics and the slapstick, or you may not be a fan of the comedy or the humor that he brings, but you can understand Jar Jar as a plot device. So I thought it was an interesting answer. And yeah, like you said, I think there's certainly a part of it that he does have to represent well. So for a staffer from Lucasfilm to say, well, I don't like this part of Star Wars. I don't like this part of this thing that my employer created. Yeah, that's probably not the most correct thing to say in terms of your employer. But I still think from a very practical perspective and really just being more positive. I mean, there is a lot of negativity out there. And I like your approach. Like you said, you try to see the positives in all these things.
Yeah.
And not just sit there and bash them. So I think it's definitely worthwhile. It's a worthwhile comment and perspective.
Yeah. Speaking of Justin Bulger, my big celebrity moment at Star Wars Celebration, I walked by Justin Bulger and Paul Herman, And I said hello to them, and they knew who I was. They recognized my face from the internet, and they actually said, like, oh, wow, Derek, it's great to meet you. That's awesome. I was starstruck.
That's awesome.
Yeah, because I loved Justin Bolger back when he was on the Forest Cast, and I love Paul Herman when he was on the Forest Cast and on Marvel News Now. Mm-hmm. So to meet them in person just randomly and for them to know who I was, whoo, that was cool.
In the next Echo Base, going to talk some about my visit to Lucasfilm, which happened a couple weeks ago. And was basically at the invite of Justin, happened to be out there for some business stuff, and had the opportunity to visit Lucasfilm. And Justin was a very gracious host, and it was fun to hang out with him. But this is your interview, not mine. So that's a story that I'm going to talk about on the next Echo Base. But yeah, it was definitely cool to hang out there and see a lot of things. With the focus being on you, as you have probably heard from the other interviews that we've done, one of the very first questions that I like to ask folks is, where were you born?
I was born in St. Petersburg, Florida. I grew up there. I went to high school there. I was your typical nerdy, shy kid with only a couple of friends. I went to college at Florida State University, where I majored in history and education. I became a high school history teacher for 3 whole months before I walked away from it because the kids were horrible, as you can imagine. Wow. Shockingly, it turns out that teenage kids do not want to learn about ancient world history. Yeah, go figure.
Yeah, I imagine that's a challenge. I've mentioned on other podcasts, my wife is a college dean. She's been an educator. She taught in middle schools and high schools and in college. And my niece is also college faculty, and my stepson teaches at a private middle school and high school. His girlfriend teaches at a public middle school.
Oh, wow.
So I'm kind of surrounded by educators, and I definitely have an awful lot of appreciation for everything they do and everything they put up with. So I certainly don't knock your decision to walk away from it. It can be tough, and especially depending on the system that you're in and the kind of behaviors and attitudes that certain systems might foster. So it's definitely a challenging thing. Do you have any thoughts of going back into some aspect of education in the future?
Oh, God, no. I walked away from that in 2003, so 14 years ago. So I'm long past that.
Yeah. So you have so I assume then you have a master's degree.
Nope. It was just a bachelor arts? Bachelor's.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just the regular degree. I double majored in history. I basically finished a history degree, found out it was worthless for a job, and then did an education degree.
Yeah. History, there's not a lot you can do with a history degree unless you teach history.
Yeah, you can either teach or work in a museum. That's about it.
Yeah, so that's it's challenging. It's, you know, we're always encouraged in school to pursue the things that we're interested in, but I think there has to be that balance in there of, well, pursue something you're interested in, but then think about what it is that you're going to do with it once you get out of school.
Yeah, like, don't be an art history major. That's not good.
Yeah, I mean, again, unless you're going to teach it or you're going to work in a museum. I mean, that's pretty challenging. From a practical perspective, and I'm not knocking education. I think it's wonderful to learn things you don't know and to follow your passions. And we all should be lifelong learners. But there is also the practical side of a need to make money. And, you know, that's oftentimes hinged on having an education at least somewhat related to whatever the job is that you're going to hold.
And yet I ended up working in a bank.
Yeah, and you work in a bank.
Yeah.
So you, what is it that you do? You work with something to do with like fraud and debit cards or something?
I work with the ATMs and the debit cards, and I'm the one who has to process all the fraud claims. Basically anything connected to the ATMs or the debit cards I handle.
Gotcha. Okay.
It's not terribly exciting, but I can do it well enough, so.
Yeah, but I bet there's some interesting stuff in it. Do you like any interface with law enforcement for investigations or anything like that?
Nope. I just submit the cases. That's it.
Oh, okay. So you basically do the internal filing of the cases, and then there's someone else who deals with that.
Well, I mean, we submit the cases to MasterCard, and then basically the merchant, if they don't respond, we win the case. If they respond with documentation, then we can respond to their documentation, but yeah.
Gotcha. Talk to me about your fandoms, and as a kid and getting into adulthood, what were some of your early fandoms? What were things you were interested in? How did all that kind of evolve?
Well, Star Wars is obviously my number one fandom. I've loved that as long as I can remember. I've loved the books. I started all the way back with Heir to the Empire in 1991. I thought it was the most amazing thing in the world to get an actual sequel to the Star Wars movies, because back then it was three movies, period. There was nothing else. Yep. Sure. I mean, as far as I knew at the time. So one day I walked into the bookstore and they had one of those big, you know, stand up stands for it, holding a bunch of the books. And it was mm-hmm. like the next chapter of Star Wars. And I was like, what? There's another chapter? There's a fourth story? Can you imagine four whole Star Wars stories?
Yeah.
And it also helped that it was incredibly well written, and I've just been obsessed with Star Wars ever since. That's my number one.
Cool. What other types of fandoms, what other interests do you have?
I love pretty much everything. I guess my number two would be Lord of the Rings. I've read that book so many times in my life. I love it so much. And the movies are great too. And yeah, I mean, basically any fandom you could list, I probably like it. Harry Potter, Indiana Jones, The Matrix, all the Marvel movies, of course. I read comic books a lot when I was a kid. I read a little bit now. Obviously, they're so expensive, you can't read much of them. Because when you're spending $4 or $5 for something that takes you 5 minutes to read, I don't understand who the demographic is for that. I mean, who can afford to buy all these things unless you're a rich 30-year-old who grew up on the comic books? I don't understand how, like, a young kid nowadays could ever afford to buy these things.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when I was a kid and early teenager, when I did most of my collecting, I mean, we were looking at $1, maybe $1.50.
Yeah, me too. Are we the same age? I'm 36.
I'm a little older. Okay. I got a few years on you, but not by much. Yeah, they were a lot less expensive, and now, I mean, for as much as I still appreciate comics, I don't read them as extensively as I used to. I prefer trades, kind of, you know, and maybe it's just part of our current culture of wanting to consume everything when you want to. I like to pick up the trades so I can read, you know, essentially a number of comics at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of part of that same story. And I'm actually kind of ticked off about the gazillions of variant covers. I mean, I'm okay, you know, if there's a few variant covers, but I think things are getting out of hand when you have dozens of different variant covers just for the same issue.
Yeah, but I mean, if you don't care about variant covers, there's nothing that makes you buy them. You know, I mean, like, you there's no reason to have to get them.
Oh, true.
It's completely true. Optional.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think it seems to do a disservice for the collectors. And I guess some of the collectors are going to say, hey, you know, no, there's no problem with it. We absolutely love it. We love going out there and it's the thrill of the hunt and we find these things. And, you know, some people are going to order them on Amazon. Some of them are going to, you know, get them off of Craigslist. Some people are just going to find them in the wild, whatever the case may be. But then you also hear some collectors who kind of feel compelled to get them, and they kind of complain about it. I mean, granted, it's their choice still to go out there and pursue these things, but it just seems crazy. I think it drives a false demand for those. I mean, again, when you and I were growing up with comics, you might get some special covers. You know, you might get a glow-in-the-dark cover. You might get a
holographic foil.
Yeah, holographic foil. You might get, you know, some different things like that. Once in a while, there might be a variant, but it was very, very rare. And now it's like, well, everything does variants. And yeah. every number one issue has multiple variants. And every, you know, special anniversary issue has gazillions of variants. And conceptually, and again, it kind of like you said, it doesn't impact me because I'm not out there looking for them. But the concept of it just kind of bothers me.
Well, I think it's basically the dying gasp to keep the brick and mortar stores alive, because obviously comic books are going to go all digital mm-hmm. a few years from now. There's not going to be paper comics anymore. Sure. And then all those brick and mortar comic book stores are going to go out of business then. So the only way you can get these variant covers is by ordering 50 or 100 copies of the comic book. So basically, only a comic book store can get those variant covers, which then they can sell at high profit. So.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. We'll see how much further this goes along. And I think you're right. A lot of people consume comic books digitally. I've gotten a few myself digitally. I like the format. I like how, like, Comixology, I like how their app works and how you can kind of move through the comic. That said, I still like to have physical comics on hand. But aside from picking up a handful of, you know, picking up a trade here and there, I really don't have a lot of storage room for them.
Yeah. Yeah. I back in my childhood home, I have, I think, like 10 boxes of comic books sitting in a closet.
So you live up in Pennsylvania now?
Yes. In 2004, I moved up here ostensibly to be a teacher, but of course that never happened.
Ah, okay. So you just ended up staying there after that experience and just kind of continue to find your way instead.
Yeah, my sister lives up here, so I had family here. So
okay, very good. And you mentioned, I know this weekend, part of our scheduling was that you were hanging out with your sister's kids.
Oh, yeah, that was one day, but this weekend I'm dog sitting for her.
Ah, okay.
Oh, I forgot about Star Trek. I love Star Trek, too. That's my other big fandom.
What's your favorite series?
Deep Space Nine by a mile.
I like the feel of Deep Space Nine.
I'm all about war stories and continuity, so DS9 is the defining Trek for me.
Yeah.
That was actually the series that got me into sci-fi, now that I think about it. It was the double punch of Deep Space Nine and The X-Files. Those two turned me into a fanatic.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And X-Files is it's an interesting rabbit hole to jump down. For as defined as the series is, it can just go anywhere. Have you been a fan of the new material for X-Files that they've put out or no?
I did not really like the revival season that they did. I absolutely loved, I think it was the third episode, the Darren Morgan comedy one about the werewolf who becomes a human, played by the guy from Flight of the Conchords, Rhys Darby, I think his name is. That episode was a 4-star classic. All the other ones I thought were deeply disappointing.
Hmm.
But, you know, I mean, X-Files really kind of limped along at the end there. To me, it was at its best in seasons, let's say, 3 to 6.
Yeah.
And then 7, 8, 9, you know, it was all right.
Yeah, I agree. I was never a huge fan of it. I certainly did not see every episode, but from those that I did watch, mid-series, those seem to be the better ones. They seem to be the most compelling. They had the best stories, the most interesting stories in them. Obviously, early on, early on, things are a little shaky. You kind of have to give it a chance. And later on, it just kind of seems like they ran out of stuff to do.
Yeah. And I was so obsessed with that show in the middle years. Actually, I ran a X-Files website that analyzed the mythology conspiracy episodes. And I would, you know, like pick apart every little detail and count how many like pods there were on the screen and things like that. And like do the math about it.
Oh, cool.
I was insanely detailed. This website doesn't exist anymore. This was back in the GeoCities days.
Ah, yep. Yep.
But at the time I really picked it apart. And this of course is back in the days of taping it yourself off of broadcast on VHS. So you have to like, you know, pause the screen. The screen is jumping,
oh,
and
yeah,
moving.
Yep. Yeah, shaky VHS, pause screen, yeah. Absolutely. With lines through it and skewed, yeah. The screen is skewed because you're stuck between, you know, one part and another part. And oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the good old days of analog recording.
And my number one favorite TV show of all time, though, is Babylon 5. That's my obsession.
Yeah, Babylon 5 is a lot of fun. Babylon 5 is just kind of this cross between Star Trek and Star Wars. And I know it's also its own very unique thing. Again, it's not something that I'm a huge fan of, but I do enjoy it when I see it. And to me, I see it as kind of this cool mashup, which then became its own thing.
Yeah, that to me is the golden child of television. And that's what I base my own story / show on a lot too. The heavily serialized storytelling, building up a single story over seasons, yet also having humor and fun in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I like shows like Battlestar Galactica and The Expanse, but they are a little too dark and grim for me. I do need to have some lightness in order to enjoy something.
Right.
I mean, I do like Galactica and Expanse a lot, but to me, the best shows is something that you can also laugh at with. Like Joss Whedon shows, Buffy and Angel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they go to very dark places, but they also have really goofy humor.
Right.
And I think that you need to have both of those things to be truly successful.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, life is an amalgamation of those things. I mean, you could be in, you know, you could go to war and there's still going to be some kind of humor that you're going to find out there, if even just simply to cope and in the worst situations. So I think that the things that we consume should also have that. I mean, there should be a balance. I mean, you know, as they say, everything in moderation. You can have something skewed toward being very serious, but if there's not even an ounce of humor in it, that I actually have a more difficult time in suspending my reality than the context or situations that they're putting us in.
Yeah, and of course, that's not to say that there's not a time for a serious story. Like, there shouldn't be jokes in Schindler's List. But, you know, like, I wouldn't want to watch a lot of something that's so dark and serious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for it to have rewatch value, for me to want to spend time with it, it's got to have some fun, too.
Sure, sure. Exactly. And yeah, I agree with what you say in terms of rewatch, and especially if something is a series. If something is a series, there has to be some measure of humor in it.
Yeah, especially if you're going to binge watch it. Wouldn't want to binge watch, like, yeah, 6 hours of something that's, like, you know, wrist-slittingly depressing.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. Your writing, I think, is to me, the most interesting part of you that I know of.
Thank you.
No, the absolute true compliment. I definitely respect it. Obviously, I know that you have a lot of writing projects that have not gone out to anyone. But from the things that I've seen that you've written, like your movie reviews and that kind of stuff that you've posted, you are a great writer. You have a lot of talent. And tell me more about your writing. When did writing start for you?
I was writing even before I could write. I have a very vague early memory of being a little kid sitting in the bathtub and narrating a story to my mom, who I guess was writing it down.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I think my earliest story was called Space Cowboys, and it was about Rock Dodger and Mimos, and they were kind of like, you know, cowboys in space.
Sure. Oh, Rock Dodger is like, that's Rock such Dodger. A great name.
Yeah. And Mimos was actually my invisible friend for a while. Okay. I remember buckling Mimos's seatbelt in the backseat of the car. As an actual writer, my main story is a sci-fi TV series. It's I'm basically writing it as a book at the moment,
mm-hmm.
but it's a 7-season TV show that translates into 14 books. Each book is half a season of mm-hmm. a TV show. And I've been writing that since 1993.
Wow.
But I didn't really start writing it until a few years ago. Like, I've basically been outlining and, you know, I wrote a little bit here and there. But I've actually been sitting down and regularly writing it for the past few years. I'm currently on book 5 of 14.
How long about are each book?
Each book is approximately, I want to say, 100,000 words. Okay. It's a normal book length. It's not super long.
Okay.
And each book is 11 episodes of a TV show. So I literally keep the 5-act structure of the television show and the length of the television show. So if I ever get these books published, it'd be literally like reading a TV show in a book form, mm-hmm. which I think would be really cool because personally, I have a really short attention span. It's about 20 to 45 minutes long, which is why I like television.
Sure.
So the thought of reading a book that's divided into these television episode-sized chapters, I think that would be the neatest thing.
So actually what you're telling me is that 45 minutes into this interview, you're just going to disconnect and you're gone.
Yeah, I'm just going to start playing on my phone and drowning you out then, and I'll be like, what? Huh?
That's fine. People have done worse. Fortunately, not on these interviews. Is your intent to have these published as books, or do you want to try to pitch them to have them done to put them out there as treatments for TV shows? Or what's your kind of ultimate goal with these?
My greatest pie in the sky dream is to get the show made as a television show. And I'm basically using the books as an avenue to get there.
Okay.
So hopefully, like, I can get one or two of them published and drum up enough interest to actually get a TV show made, like The Expanse.
Sure. Are you going to write all 14 before you try to pitch it, or are you going to maybe get, you know, a few more in and see what you can do with it?
Well, I'm basically writing them because I don't have anything else to write at the moment. And also, it really is my life's work, and I want to, you know, get it written down before I die.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as it's available, I will try to sell it. My current plan is, so I have one novel and two or three short stories published at the moment. So that kind of got me to be what I call a Z-grade author. And there's a pretty good chance that I'm about to get a short story published in a larger anthology that actually has some famous people on it.
Oh, cool.
And that would make me a Y-grade author.
Okay.
So my ultimate goal is to get to be a BB-grade author.
Ha-ha.
So I have to just, you know,
I see what you did there.
I have to climb every little ring of the ladder. So what I'm currently doing is I also have a high fantasy trilogy, which I've completely finished writing. It's basically my version of Lord of the Rings. And I'm shopping that to agents at the moment. So my next goal is to get an agent and to get my fantasy trilogy published. And then from there, I can try to get the sci-fi series published. And then from there, I can try to get the sci-fi TV series made.
Sure. Well, I mean, it kind of makes sense that you get your foot in the door.
Yeah.
And then the more exposure you have, you can kind of reach for the bigger projects.
Yeah, I'm basically trying to take my little baby steps and very slowly get there.
Cool. So you mentioned you had a novel published and a short story?
Yes, it's in a kind of a comedic fantasy franchise. It's called Fortanis. It's based on a live-action role-playing game that my editor created. And I just happened to meet him because we live in the same city, and he did a writer's conference, and I went to it, and I sat in the front and asked a lot of questions. And he formed a monthly writer's group to meet, and I went to it every time. And, you know, he writes fantasy, I write fantasy, so he said, hey, I'm doing an anthology, you can submit a story. And he took it, and it got published. And then that story I then fleshed out into a full-length novel,
wow,
which he published. So the first thing ever got published is a short story that was then blown up into a full-length novel. And then another short story is a prequel to that one. And then another one is a sequel to that one. So that's what has been published or is going to be published. And then the next thing that I'm hoping it gets published is a Sherlock Holmes science fiction story.
Wow.
He does an anthology of alternate versions of Sherlock Holmes, and I did a sci-fi one that takes place in the future on the moon.
Oh, very cool.
So if that gets accepted, which I hope it will, that will be my next big step. Because like I said, that's an anthology with people who actually, you know, are famous.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a big step for me.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's great. So you're looking to go the... largely for your stuff, you want to go the traditional route, get an agent, get stuff actually put out there instead of doing the self-publishing gig.
Yeah, I know that it's slowly changing, but to my mind and to my editor's mind, self-publishing is still not the way to get famous. I mm-hmm. mean, once you are famous, you can self-publish and people will buy it.
Mm-hmm.
But to my mind, if I'm if there's no gatekeepers with self-publishing.
Right.
Anybody can write any piece of crap full of typos and horrible language and just stick it out there. And then it's just lost in a sea of garbage. And if I write something good and I put it in that same sea of garbage, how is anyone ever going to find it and know to look for it and find out that it's good?
Yeah.
There has to be some measure of quality for it to be worth reading.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's a good perspective on it. I mean, it's kind of like the concept of peer review in academia. Even though it's a little bit different, I mean, this is not necessarily going up in front of a panel of people in most cases. Get shoved in front of one person or a few people in series to kind of say, hey, what do you think? Is it worthwhile and can we make money off of it? Because, of course, that's going to be their interest in it. Will they think that it's going to sell? But there is, I think, at least from the stuff that I've heard and the things that I pay attention to, actually going through an agent has a greater profit potential for the author as well.
Yeah. And the other thing is that the way the publishing industry works now, sending an unsolicited query to a major publisher is not going to get you anywhere. You have to have an agent for any major publisher to even take a look at you.
Hmm. So you're kind of shopping around for agents right now?
Yeah. Well, I haven't actually applied to anyone recently, but that's one of those things I keep putting off, but yeah. That's the next phase.
Are agents generally genre specific? So are they like sci-fi agents, high fantasy agents?
Yes, agents represent very specific things. So you can't just pick a name out of a phone book. You actually have to find out someone that is specifically into that.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, there's not a lot of sci-fi fantasy agents out there.
Right.
That would take, you know, a nobody like me. So my options are limited.
Well, if there is anyone out there, any of our listeners who happen to be an agent or know of any agent, please, you know, have them get a hold of Derek. You can get us through Random Chatter. You can get him, since he is the man behind the Random Chatter Facebook page, you can hit him up there. And at the end of our podcast here, Derek, you'll be able to throw out there all your social media contact info and such, so... Who knows?
Or maybe. If you're a millionaire, and you just want to, you know, pay to publish it for me, that's good too.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Absolutely. So if anyone can help out Derek in his endeavors, I think it's definitely worthwhile to do so. Seriously, your writing is awesome stuff. And I know we've had some kind of small group discussions on Slack when you've tried to throw some different things out there about what you're writing to kind of either see what would stick or see what seems realistic or try to shoot holes through a certain concept. And those have come up with some interesting discussions. And I like that. And I've definitely tried to give some of my feedback and hopefully it's been valuable.
Yeah. After writing the same story since 1993, it's, you know, I've gotten a lot, you know, obviously I have a lot of research and work put into it and I have my own little rules for space combat, for man to man combat. Because in my story, people have superpowers,
mm-hmm.
So it's kind of comic book superheroes meets Babylon 5 meets Star Wars meets West Wing.
Sure. Well, but when you build something like that, yeah, you absolutely have to kind of outline what your own rules are. How does your universe work? Essentially, that's really important to do that because you need to have that standard as you write because you have to pay attention to it. If you create a rule in book one, that same rule, unless somehow there's a viable means of getting around it, or explaining some kind of change to it that needs to be consistent.
Yeah. That's the hardest thing when writing, when you have to put your heroes in a bind and they have to somehow get out of it in a plausible way. Sometimes the greatest feeling in the world is when I actually think of a good solution to that for them to win or for them to escape in a way that's not stupid and is actually clever.
Sure. Do you have all 14 of these books, like even conceptually outlined? Do you know where this is going to go and what's going to happen? Or is this just kind of developing as you write?
Oh, I have them deeply plotted out already. I have in-depth outlines for everything. Yeah, I know what happens in every single episode. I have a pretty long paragraph for them. I've written some of them out in the past as scripts, though obviously they would change a lot now. But, I mean, that's not to say that the story doesn't change, though. That's actually been the really exciting thing about finally writing this story that I've been working on for decades, because the act of writing it changes it.
Yes.
And improves it, because I can spend 25 years plotting this story out, but you still can't think of everything. And when you actually get to write something, you think like, well, what is this character doing? How does this person feel about this? How does this change? What are you missing? So it's been really exciting to write out my life's work and actually see it, you know, change and evolve and get better.
Absolutely. Well, and it is, and you mentioned the characters, and I think that great thing is that as you continue to write and you continue to develop those characters, you may find that a certain pre-established plot point that you outlined several years ago, you end up defeating that or going around it because you realize, you know what, my character would never do that. My character wouldn't approach it that way. They would do this instead. Because you now know more about your characters than you did before.
Yeah, yeah. The same general events are all still happening, but the minor points are changing. Mm-hmm. And the character motivations are changing as well.
Have you found yourself going backwards at all as you've kind of evolved in not only your own prowess of writing and your own skill of writing, but also as the story evolves, you realize, hey, you know what? I don't like what I did back there. I need to fix that, or I have a better idea for it, or something like that.
I have gone back and made a few minor changes here and there. And I do need to completely rewrite the pilot because that was written almost 10 years ago at this point. Mm-hmm. And I'm a completely different writer now than I was 10 years ago.
Sure. I certainly believe that.
Yeah.
And you want things to be done in a similar style, and you now have certain quality expectations of yourself and your own writing. You want to have consistency.
Yeah.
You mentioned working with an editor. Have you had an editor looking at any of this content yet, or is this still just all you?
No, it's all me. My editor, his name is Michael Ventrella. He's a semi-famous author, and he knows a lot of famous people, too. He's the one who runs the Fortanis franchise. He created the live-action role-playing game, which is actually played across America and in Canada. It's this huge thing, and he created it, which is really impressive. And he has several books published on his own, and he edits the anthologies that I've been published in. But I haven't shown him any of this stuff. He's only seen the Fortanis stories that I've done and the Sherlock story, because he's also editing that.
Cool.
But in terms of my own original stories, no, it's just me.
Neat. Okay. I'm sure, you know, handing it over to an editor has got to be kind of intimidating. You know, it's like giving your baby to someone else and saying, yeah, here, you go ahead and do something with it and let me know how things work out. That's got to be a little scary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He would point out, you know, some errors that I never saw. And point out some things that, you know, I didn't think were errors, and we would have to kind of go back and forth about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting experience.
But you, again, I'm only getting a small perspective of kind of the discussion that you've had with some of us in Slack about this, but you seem very receptive to different ideas. And I mean, in fact, you seek out ideas. So I think you probably take some constructive critiques pretty well, so long as people are understanding the story that you've created.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, if I feel strongly about something, I will argue for it.
Sure. Well, you're still the author. It's your creation. It's your creation. So that's, you know, it kind of always goes back to you.
Yep.
I think that's really cool. Where do you get in terms of writing? Do you listen to podcasts on writing? You said you've done some things with writers groups. How have you kind of honed your craft as an author?
Well, I don't listen to any writing podcasts. I basically listen to podcasts for comedy or for you know, like the random chatter stuff, discussion of things that I love.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a writing podcast would be a little too dry for me. But I have read a lot of writing, you know, how to write books. And I do go to the monthly writers group and the conferences that they run. But really, I think it's just watching TV and movies and reading a lot of books and looking at them analytically, not just enjoying the story, but understanding the structure and the choices behind it. And my favorite thing in the world is to read about how the writers came up with stories for TVs or movies or books, to listen to the commentary tracks on movies, interviews from the writers, that sort of thing, where they talk about the process of how they came up with the story and how it changed and where it could have gone otherwise. That's really, I think, is my number one learning tool.
Yeah, that behind the scenes stuff is always pretty interesting. And it gets you, sometimes if they do it well enough, it gets you into the head of the creators. And regardless of whether it's a visual medium versus a written medium, I think a lot of that creative process is still very similar. Similar enough that you can apply it to what you're doing.
Yeah, because whether it's a movie or a TV show or a book, a story is a story.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although that was also my error as a starting out writer that I had to be corrected on, because I would literally write things, because I basically started writing screenplays for all my early years, and then I switched to prose around 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of had a struggle to adjust to that, because I would write things as basically a screenplay in prose form without any internal monologues or thoughts.
Sure.
And very little scenery description. I still believe in using as few words as possible. Personally, for me, if I'm reading a book and I see a solid page of just like one paragraph of describing text, that turns me off.
Mm.
To me, just as in a movie or a TV show, an action scene would be eye candy, to me in a book, white space is eye candy, usually from dialogue. You're looking forward to the dialogue because it moves fast, because there's white space and you're jumping from line to line. But if it's just a fat block of prose, it's just a chore to get through.
Sure.
For me. But like I said, I have a short attention span, so.
Well, and it's everyone has their different likes and dislikes, so I'm sure that authors like Stephen King or Tolkien are not amongst your favorites in terms of at least their written work, because they go on exhaustively with descriptions.
Yeah, well, like I said, Tolkien, I love Lord of the Rings. That's kind of my one glaring exception to the rule.
Mm-hmm.
I can read those over and over, even though they are the opposite of everything I just said.
Right,
but
right.
The story is just so important and good. And I actually enjoy the scenery descriptions in Lord of the Rings, which, again, is the only exception to that rule. But the way it describes the fictional world for you, it just really puts you in there so much.
Who's your favorite author?
Favorite author? Well, I mean, if we're talking of all time, Tolkien.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of modern releases, I really like the Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child novels.
Mm-hmm.
They are detective crime thrillers.
Yep.
It's basically a modern-day Sherlock Holmes. It's called the Agent Pendergast series.
Mm-hmm.
They release one book every year, and then they also do solo books as well that are out of continuity with that series. But they are incredible page turners. Most of them have light genre elements. There's like a little bit of sci-fi fantasy, but scientifically explained.
Mm-hmm.
And then their side solo books, those will tend to be a little more crazy. Like, you know, it might involve, you know, aliens, but in a very realistic way, you know, like they find a ruin at the bottom of the ocean, and they find out it's, you know, an alien spaceship or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would highly recommend those. They're really good page turners. Every chapter, you know, ends on a cliffhanger and you got to find out what happens next. They're great.
Yeah.
And Agent Pendergast is a wonderful character. Like I said, he's a modern day Sherlock Holmes. He's brilliant. He's an asshole. But he gets the job done.
Sure.
He's a really great character.
Yeah, I've read a couple of Lincoln and Child books, and I
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Which ones?
I couldn't tell you offhand.
Okay.
I like the stuff that they write. I like the style that they write in. It's some pretty compelling stuff.
Yeah.
Do you read the new Star Wars novels?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I have to read every Star Wars novel.
Okay. What's been your favorite so far in this reset continuity?
Geez. Now I have to think of them all. Oh, the Thrawn novel, of course.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I hate to be like a bandwagon person, but Tim Zahn's writing is brilliant. The Thrawn character is brilliant.
Yeah.
Mild spoiler here if you haven't read the Thrawn book, but it's been out for a while for our listeners. But to me, the Thrawn book read like a sci-fi Sherlock Holmes novel.
Mm-hmm.
To me. And I love that aspect of it. And, you know, like you said with Lincoln and Child, it's like, oh, you know, a chapter ends and you're so compelled, even though it's 2 o'clock in the morning and your eyes are so tired. I got to read the next chapter because I got to figure out how he's going to solve this problem or get out of this situation. And to me, it was a serious page turner. I loved it.
Yeah. And I don't want to spoil anything about the ending, but it was a really good ending too, that just really blew my eyes open. There's a twist that I don't want to give away that just completely shocked me and was amazingly wonderful. And now I'm dying for Tim Zahn to write some more Thrawn novels.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the other thing that I loved about it was that it was not a reboot of the previous Zahn or the previous Thrawn material that he's written. He kept pretty true to the character, some slight changes in the character's background, and similar to the characterization of Thrawn that we've seen in Star Wars Rebels, that's also pretty darn consistent with the Thrawn that we've known from years back from Zahn's earlier novels.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of this stayed pretty true, and there's also some indications of some things that were speculated upon in what's, you know, now become Legends books. And not just the old Thrawn books, but also in other books. So I think it's really interesting to see what they are farming from Legends and bringing into the new canon. And I'm really excited about it. And, you know, it's made me more comfortable with the fact that they have, you know, changed canon. They basically had to reboot the canon. That the stuff that they wrote before isn't completely gone. They are going back and farming stories and characters and concepts, and, you know, they might tweak them or change them a little bit, but it's still pretty respectful, I think, to what was done in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said before, I was a huge Star Wars EU fan. I didn't read all the novels, but I'd say I read 90% of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my Star Wars in a lot of way. And when Disney bought it and they wrote it out of continuity, I was fine with it. Because they obviously had to change it. It was just a fact of life. They're not going to be beholden to a series of novels 20 years old that only a few thousand people have read, maybe a million, maybe a million or two.
Yeah.
But no, there was totally no way the movies were going to be bound by those. It was just never going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. I mean, those novels were allowed to go in places where they went because there was not, for the longest period of time, there was not an expectation that there would be movies set after Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
And, they realized they couldn't go in those directions and those stories were told. You know, you then run the risk of, gee, how do we put into a visual medium the stuff that was written, and what if we deviate from it? And, not to speak poorly of Star Wars fans, because I is one. But there are some fans who would get seriously ticked off if the movie version of some arc of books was significantly changed. So I think it made sense for them to do what they did. And like you, I read, you know, I pretty much figure somewhere around 85% of the novels, and you know, it was minorly soul-crushing the day that news came out that, hey, all the stuff that was written, nope, it's gone. But then I got the perspective of, well, you know what, it's not gone. We can still enjoy it. It's not necessarily canonical, but they're still great stories, and there's nothing wrong with them.
Yeah, I mean, to my mind, there's just basically two divergent timelines, just like the Star Trek movies are now divergent from the rest of the franchise. And that's fine. You know, you can have two different types of stories.
Yeah.
And I'm actually convinced that a few years down the road, they're going to start publishing novels in the Legends continuity again once the nostalgia has built up and enough time has passed that people understand the difference. Because they're still printing Legends novels. Yeah. It's not like they all went out of print. They're still making them over and over and over again just with the Legends banner on it. So it's not like they're pretending they never existed like the Jendi Tartakovsky 2003 Clone Wars series, which was just wiped from existence.
Yeah.
You know, they're still out there. You can still buy them.
Exactly. Exactly, yeah. And I think... I do agree with you. I think that when some measure of time goes by, Del Rey is going to say, hey, look, we're still making money off of these, and there's still interest in these stories, even if they are not canonical. Let's pull some authors together to do some stuff. And I'll tell you, I hope the first book that's published is Sword of the Jedi, because I mean, gosh, that was probably one of the most highly anticipated novels for such a long time as soon as we heard of it, and the timing of this change in canon occurred, I think, you know, very close to publication. So it was an absolute shame that that book never got published. And I hope, you know, it's still somewhere, so it can actually be retrieved at some point.
This might be sacrilegious to say, but Jaina was never really my favorite character. I don't know. I always just thought she was kind of a two-dimensional cross between Han and Leia, personality-wise? I don't know.
Yeah, I think personality-wise, I don't disagree with that. I think she did fall a little flat, although I liked her story arc. So I would have liked to have seen a little more development of the character to fit within that story arc. And I was really hoping that Sword of the Jedi was just that.
Yeah.
Because it was supposed to be focused on her. And I was hoping that that would see some more growth of her. You know, I think there was just so much competition for characters. You know, they spent so much time on the, you know, rise and fall of her brother Jason. And she just kind of became a background character in many ways to a lot of that story. Until they pushed her up front. And when they pushed her up front, again, great story arc, but there wasn't a lot of character behind her.
I think the other problem was, I don't know, I mean, it's been a while since I've read these, but did she ever really have a sense of humor, or was she always kind of like angry and gritty? And
I think she eventually developed one.
Because the problem was, I don't know, well, the problem with the whole New Jedi Order arc, first of all, is that it was too dark. But, I mean, she basically spends the whole arc being angry and gritty, and then she falls to the dark side, and then she becomes a bug. And then she has to, you know, go after her brother. You know, it was all a downer for her. Not to mention the whole thing with Jag. I don't know. Like she never really had a good time. My subjective memory is that she never really had a sense of humor. She was always just kind of angry and tortured.
Well, it's a tough life to be part of the Skywalker Solo family.
Yeah,
I think that is the ultimate lesson to be learned in all of Star Wars. If you are a part of that family, you're pretty much screwed.
And you should castrate yourself to preserve future generations.
You probably should. That would absolutely, like, save apocalyptical things from happening in the future.
You could probably just use a lightsaber. It'd be really easy.
Yes. Yeah.
They cauterize the wound.
Oh. You know? Oh. All right. Let's talk about something else. that's causing me pain. Derek, tell me about your relationship with Subway. let's explore that.
I do talk about it a lot as a joke. In reality, I go to Subway 2 to 3, maybe 4 times a week.
That's still a lot, Derek.
Yeah, I know it's a lot, but what, I don't know. I just find it really relaxing to get out of work if I don't have anything else to do with, like, you know, a friend or something, to get out of work, go to the subway down the road, get my sub, get my soda, and just plug in and listen to a Random Chatter podcast. I just find it very relaxing, and I just sit there for an hour, you know, going on my phone, listening to the podcast, sipping soda, mm-hmm. watching the cars go by outside the window. It's just very relaxing.
Okay.
And it's just kind of like a habit that I fell into, and I just like it.
Okay. So Subway is your relationship, and CC's is kind of like a mistress on the side?
Yes. I need to not go to CC's because that's the ultimate calorie bomb. I basically do that. And CC's is 30 minutes down the highway. So basically I do that if it's a weekend day and I have literally nothing else to do. And I'll just do that to, you know, kill the whole day.
Gotcha. What's your usual Subway order?
I get a steak and egg. It's a breakfast sub, but you can get it all day. It's the cheapest thing on the menu, and it's actually pretty low in calories because it's egg and steak, and I get chipotle mayo on it, which obviously is bad, but you need it for the taste. But it's cheap, it's delicious, and here's a little secret. 90% of the time, the employee doesn't know to give you half meat because in a breakfast sub, you're only supposed to get half of it. They give you the full amount of meat that you would have gotten had you bought the extra priced steak sub. So you're getting double meat for free with egg. Yeah. Wow.
Subway yeah. survival tips from Derek Beebe.
Yeah. Hopefully that doesn't get out.
I can't think of any other way to end this interview, Derek. I think we truly have to end it with those incredible words of wisdom on ordering from Subway.
And let me just say that all the horrible things I say in Slack are just jokes.
Sure. Sure, Derek. That's fine. That's fine. That's how we have Slackbot actually policing you. Derek, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter at Derek J. Beebe. I'm on Facebook, Derek Beebe. I am on randomchatter.com. I have my own website that doesn't get updated, derekbeebe.com, which is basically for my books. And you can find me on Slack, which you can join for only $1 a month. And it's the greatest deal in the world because talking on Slack is so much fun with all our fellow Star Wars Random Chatter fans.
That's awesome. See, so I don't even have to pitch it. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I pre-pitched you.
Nice job, Derek. And that's for everyone, BB is spelled B-E-E-B-E.
Yes, nobody gets that right. And anytime somebody reads it, they think it's Beeb.
Ah.
But now it's BB.
Yeah. You're not like a cousin of the Beeb, Justin Bieber.
Oh, God, no.
Yeah, no.
He's Canadian.
No. No offense, Joel.
Yeah, no offense, Joel.
And many of I love Canada. Other Canadian listeners.
Yeah. I'm a total Anglophile.
Is there anything you want to pitch? This is your platform. Make it happen, BB.
You want to hear my crazy, what's the word? What the Unabomber's manifesto.
Manifesto, yes.
You want to hear my crazy manifesto?
So long as it's a brief manifesto.
No, I don't really have anything to pitch. If you wanted to, you could buy my book. You just have to, it's on Amazon.com. It's on Barnes & Noble's. If you type in Derek Beebe, my author page will come up. So you can do that if you want.
Very cool.
The ebook is pretty cheap. The paperback is like $13, but you can get the ebook for like $6 or $7.
Awesome. Well, Derek, thank you very much for joining me this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate you being on. It was a good time. Glad we got to hear a little bit more about you. And now our listeners certainly know a little bit more about you when, you know, they hear your name regularly referenced in practically every single podcast on this network. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, that's Derek Beebe.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed our sixth episode of Random Chatter Interviews featuring Derek Beebe. You can catch Derek on the upcoming Sci-Fi Pubcast. Be sure to follow Derek on Twitter at DerekJBeebe, that's B-E-E-B-E, and chat it up with him on the Random Chatter Facebook page. You can find the Random Chatter Network online at randomchatter.com, on Facebook at facebook.com/randomchatternetwork, and on Twitter at randomchatter. Send emails to randomchatter@randomchatter.com. I'm Qui-Gon Tim, and you can find me on Twitter at Qui-Gon Tim, that's Tim with two M's. If you like what we're doing here at Random Chatter, be sure to spread the word, tell your friends, and leave us awesome reviews on iTunes and Stitcher. We also appreciate some financial support to help us keep showering you in podcasting primordial goo. Visit patreon.com/randomchatter to show us some love. Even $1 a month gets you access to our Slack channel where you can hang out every day with hosts, staff, and other fans. The music featured on Random Chatter Interviews is Kaboom by I Fight Dragons. Thanks again for listening, and stay tuned on the Random Chatter feed for more Random Chatter interviews coming at you all summer long.